Linoleum Knife.
Welcome. It's Academy Award weekend, and we don't care. Except, I will say, it would be nice if our friend Dean DeBlois won Best Animated Feature. That would be awesome. That would be great for him. Although, yeah. I'm also a big fan of Isao Takahata, which I'm sure Dean is too. So if Tale of the Princess Kaguya won, that wouldn't be the worst thing either.
It would not, no. There'd be a whole lot of things in the world that would be worse than that.
Absolutely. No, but I just remember the first time that Dean was nominated for an Oscar was for Lilo and Stitch, and even he was like, Spirited Away should totally win.
Was Lilo and Stitch nominated for Best Animated Feature?
Uh-huh.
There was a Best Animated Feature Oscar back then?
Yeah,
It was like 10 years ago?
Yeah, I think the first movie to win it was Shrek, so it's been around for a while. We need to introduce our guest because she's nodding and I'm sure dying to say
things.
We
need to introduce ourselves.
That too. I'm Alonzo. This is a podcast of the cinema.
Yes.
And I'm Alonzo Duraldi.
Linoleum Knife.
And I'm Alonzo Duraldi, film reviews editor of The Wrap and film critic for What the Flick on the Young Turks Network on YouTube.
I'm Dave White. I'm the film critic for not The Wrap. That's you.
That is me.
Who do I write for?
Movies.com.
Yes.
And joining us today, once again, our good friend Ingu Kang, also woo, a film critic for The Wrap and for Village Voice and for The LA Times.
Right? Formerly of The LA Times.
Oh, really? Oh, yes. Okay, well. We'll talk about that off air. Welcome back.
You own the record now for being the guest that we've had back faster. For a second.
That's true.
It's only because I know you want to argue with
anyone else. We totally want to argue with you. That's why. That's why I actually rearranged our recording day to accommodate your schedule so that we could have you on.
My arguing
so
schedule.
That we could argue with you. Yes. Well, so I could argue
with Dave was going to argue with her. And since you're here, I have an argument to have with you as well. So
all right.
That'll be great. But no, in the context of obviously, like, you know, we respect your opinion. We think you're really cool. And because your take
on... fighting is fun.
Yes. And your take on certain recent films has been so diametrically opposed to ours that we just thought it'd be interesting to sort of... unpack that a little.
You guys were wrong.
We're still
it happens to everyone.
We're still smarting over that one.
I don't know how it happened to me that I was so wrong. I'm basing this on the other statistics, you know, the Metacritics and the Rotten Tomatoes. Apparently, I am in the minority.
Yeah.
More people like The Duff.
Then, was that pause there? Because you could barely get
the words out of my mouth. That is correct.
Well, look, Ingu and all these other critics are obviously in the pocket of Dave and Buster's.
Did you get gift cards? Because if I had gotten some Dave and Buster's gift cards, I could have been swayed.
I only found out what a Dave and Buster's is through this movie.
There's one at Hollywood and Highland.
Okay. I mean, the movie did a very thorough explanation of what
it is,
so.
It's practically a third character.
Yes, it is a third character. Or a sixth or seventh character, depending on how far down the roster you want to get it. There is a Dave and Buster's in Hollywood.
I ate at one once in Dallas, but it was lunch, so it wasn't like a jamboree of skee ball and whatever else goes on there.
It's like Chuck E. Cheese for adults, right?
That's kind of my impression. Yeah,
yeah, pretty much. But free food is free food.
But with booze.
And so, now I know that before the screening they were handing out Dave and Buster's gift cards.
Oh, really?
To audience members, because it was a radio screening.
Oh, what did they have to do to get them?
Just jump up and down and run down and get the card.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And so, you know, obviously I'm barred from doing that.
Whenever I go to radio screenings, it's always it's always like the local sort of hip-hop station, and people have to like go through the alphabet and name artists whose name starts with the, you know, like A, B, C, you know. But they always...
That always drives me insane.
Because people always do first names, and the reason they do it is because iTunes alphabetizes everybody by first name now. So I can't imagine... I mean, thank God there's no record stores anymore, because how would they alphabetize their CDs?
I think the muffins are burning. Continue talking while I check them out. I thought I did this right.
So here's a serious question.
Shoot.
Have you guys ever thought about changing your name from Dave and Alonzo to Dave and Buster so that you could get them for free?
If you could give me a gift card, yeah.
I am never going by Buster's, so I that seems like it'd be a bit
Buster
of a stretch.
Buster Duvaldi.
Buster Duvaldi. Yeah, that would be like if I were a Cuban boxer in another life, maybe that might have been my nickname, but otherwise, I don't see that sticking. But I don't know. Interestingly enough, it's weird because the Duff is coming out the same week that the Breakfast Club is celebrating its 30th anniversary, which makes me feel super old.
And the Duff sasses the Breakfast Club right from the get go.
Oh, does it?
Mm-hmm. It does.
Well, I didn't see this movie and I hate it already. No, I apparently have to go see it this week because Christy Lemire got a message on Twitter from the author of the book, who says she's a big fan of What the Flick and was hoping we would review it. So
who's the author of the book?
Her name is Cody Kiplinger, and okay. She wrote the novel that the movie is based on while she was in high school.
Interesting.
So she's a veritable Françoise Sagan.
Yeah. Bret Easton Ellis.
Or that 15-year-old Nick what have you who was like a publishing... Well, anyway...
Wait, who's that?
I wonder, have you read the book?
Have not read the book.
I'm curious to read the book now that I've disliked the film so much, because I want to know if the book does what the film does. You know, if the book takes the same sort of what I consider to be absolutely muddled stances on, you know, what a teenage girl should want.
Should we talk about what it is?
Then? Yes.
Okay.
Describe the film.
All right.
Yes.
The film is great. it stars Mae Whitman, who plays a high school senior, and basically she learns that she is termed the Duff, or designated ugly fat friend, by this more popular boy who happens to be her next door neighbor. And basically she's trying to figure out like how to live with this label of being called the Duff, and the conclusion that you sort of like come up with, which is like, why do you care what other people say? You should only care about what you think about yourself. I mean, that sort of like boilerplate like moral lesson for a high school. I think what the movie does extremely well is give you a very good teen romance between Mae Whitman, the Duff, and this like very popular high school boy. And even though I just spoiled the ending, it's not really a spoiler at all, because right. You know,
get together,
that's what's coming.
Oh my God.
Yes. And so I would like to know what you think that the movie does so that I can disagree with you.
Okay, so Mae Whitman's character is presented at the beginning of the film as being really self-confident. Like she knows that she's unlike the other kids in school. She is a huge horror fan, obsessed with horror films. She's really smart. She's got, you know, she does well in school. She's a teen journalist for the school newspaper. And she dresses how she wants. She wears like overalls and baggy stuff and flannel shirts, and she doesn't care. Hey, there goes the muffin alarm. But I took those muffins out because they were starting to get...
Yeah, take that muffin alarm.
Burnish.
You're not the boss of me.
I made chocolate chip muffins.
They're real good?
Oh, God, they are good. They're a little mushy, though.
Yeah, they're structurally unsound.
Structurally
but
unsound. They're like collapsy, but still delicious. I don't know what happened. I think I was trying to take them out of the tin too soon.
Ah.
I think that might have been part of it.
Could be.
But I had to get the other ones in. I only have one tin.
Well, we need to work on that.
I know. I got to get a new tin. An extra.
Yeah.
For double the muffins.
Okay, so the Duff.
What were we talking about?
You were saying how the film portrays her at the beginning as being a freak.
So she... there would seem to be no problem.
Here's the thing, though.
Yeah.
If you have this very confident girl,
yeah,
and then she gets called the Duff.
Yes.
And then she's like, well, like, screw that guy. Then there's no movie.
Right.
So I feel like what you want is no movie.
What I want is, I'm fine with her having a crisis of confidence, you know. But the trajectory of her rebuilding her confidence involves sort of abandoning what she is. She goes to the idiot jock who is her childhood friend,
Who's played by Robbie.
And they've grown apart. Like, they're next-door neighbors. They were babies together. They were little kids together. Like, they took baths together. You know, like, that kind of thing.
And now he's Firestorm.
And now he's, now he is the obnoxious jock of the school, real hot. He gets all the chicks, you know, all that stuff. And she finds him repellent.
Right.
She goes to him and she says, okay, look, you're failing chemistry. And I'm going to help you. And here's what you're going to do for me. You're going to teach me how not to be the duff, okay? And you're going to teach me how to get this dude that I want because he's not looking at me. The other thing she does is immediately dump her two best female friends angrily without any sort of in-depth discussion over what happened or what it means or what they think.
The ones who duffed her in the first place?
Yeah, the ones who never duffed
her. Unintentionally
duffed her. Yeah, they never duffed her. Other people said this about her. They never said it to her.
Well, because there's that old Kathy Griffin line about whenever there's three female friends, there's the smart one, there's the pretty one, and then there's the hoe.
Right.
You know, and so... Like,
there are two pretty...
The smart one is always the plain one.
Two, like, teen models... You know, who are smart and nice, actually. Mm-hmm. But she abandons them, like, immediately. And the conversation takes all of 10 seconds.
But here's the thing.
Okay.
I feel like you've never met a teenager before. They're very, very irrational.
Once upon a time, I was one myself.
They're very irrational beings.
That is true.
And I also really loved the fact that the movie takes as its theme the idea that a girl has to sort of be confronted with the fact that she's not as pretty as the other girls and therefore has to figure out what's special about her. I feel like that's not a theme that we get usually. I mean, like, if we think of, like, a classic teenage heroine, you think of someone who's supernaturally gorgeous, like Molly Ringwald, right? And that's not to say that Mae Whitman is not pretty and gorgeous, because obviously she is. But what I really liked about the film is that sort of having to have that particular journey. I also think that I really forgave her for ditching her friends, because if she considers herself the ugliest one of the group and she is sort of trying to figure out how to wiggle out of that label, then of course she's not going to hang out with her friends. The fact that she kind of ditches them very extremely unceremoniously also worked for me. Maybe because I feel like I did that when I was at school. But it seemed really believable.
I'm sorry to interrupting you. We need to turn down the volume or pull back.
Oh, sorry.
Your mic. We need to pull your mic back.
No, she's, believe me, her lines are way smaller than ours.
I'm getting pop, 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 pop.
Not that much.
All right. No, sure. Sorry, keep going. I'm sorry to interrupt that.
And I think that the point of the movie that is being the least undersold is this particular romance. And Whitman has, like, crazy, crazy chemistry with every single person that she shares a scene with, especially Ken Jeong, who is, like, surprisingly bearable here. And also Allison Janney, who plays confidence building
guidance counselor.
She's a motivational speaker.
Yeah. Like, that is an extremely good role for her, especially because it sort of, like, plays with her CJ role from The West Wing.
Mm-hmm.
But she has just amazing chemistry with Robbie Amell, who plays the hot jock guy, who turns out nowhere near as stupid as he's initially presented to be.
Did you just say cremazing?
Yes.
Okay, just checking. I'm trying to be down with the teen lingo. You used a word in your review that I'd never heard before.
You've never heard the term drams?
I'd never heard drams. Do you know this?
Sorry?
D-R-A-M-Z?
I know what that means.
I had never heard that word
before. I don't know what cremazing is.
It's crazy amazing.
Oh, okay. All right. Look, I'm 50.
Go on. I bring some fresh air into this.
Exactly. The old farts.
And I think the movie is really done well, and I think one of the reasons why it's done as well as it is, it's because the dialogue, a really big important part of the script to me is that the teenage characters are allowed to curse. They say lots of words I cannot say on this podcast.
Right.
And so they actually sound like teenagers, you know, you might listen to on the street. Yes. And I also love the fact that they're constantly chatting with each other on all of these different apps even I haven't heard of. And there's a whole cyberbullying angle that actually also seems quite plausible to me,
yeah.
except for its resolution, because there's some sketchy stuff there. Involving one of Bianca Make Women's character's friends, who is apparently not as smart as Bianca, but also knows how to hack Google, because
she's oh, and they sure. say at the very beginning that she's a hacker.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which you
and
know,
then they
like,
abandon that. They never explain anything else about her again.
Yeah, but
right.
whatever. So I was really okay with like all of the objections that you had. So now that I have told you that you were wrong, I have other things that I would like to tell you you're wrong about.
What else am I wrong about? Keep going.
I really think that, I mean, I wrote in like the headline of my review that this movie is this decade's Mean Girls, and I really believe it. The writing is just, you know, it's one of those laugh-a-minute scripts. The comic timing for everyone is very good. It feels both very naturalistic in terms of how the characters act with one another, while also obviously having that heightened reality so that Bianca can go through her transformation. And there is a really wonderful subversion of the makeover scene where you have sort of that like obligatory teenage girl goes to the mall, is like goes with a friend, which in this case is the guy that she's going to eventually end up with. And so she tries on outfit after outfit after outfit at like some kind of Forever 21-ish chain. And the whole point is that the whole makeover montage is a complete joke, because everything that she puts on is a complete joke. And then she actually ends up finding a dress that she actually likes. But because it's part of that whole like store / mallware / mainstream culture normcore that she's not really into, they end up doing stuff with that dress that actually turns out to be something much truer to herself.
Yes.
And so
she's pretty in pink suit.
Yes.
I've never seen Pretty in Pink.
That's exactly
what. And leave this house.
Here's what happens. I'll tell you. Here's what happens at the end of Pretty in Pink. Molly Ringwald's character is, you know, the girl from the other side of the tracks, and she's as all but the Breakfast Club Molly Ringwald characters were. She was very
funky vintage,
sort of vintagey, punk rockish, you know, kind of person.
She's the poor girl who wears the cool thrift shop clothes, while all the mean rich bitches are wearing like, you know, Reagan era couture,
padded shoulder kind of things. She makes her own prom dress at the end of the film,
out of the dress that her dad gives her,
out of a dress she it's some other kind of a dress that her father gives her, like
her mother wore it
or something like that. Yeah.
I forget.
I can't remember. She makes the dress. It's not a good looking dress, but it's her dress. Like, she makes it. And she shows up at the prom, and you're like, wow, she makes her own dress. She's so cool. The ending of this film is that moment where they take her flannel shirt and turn it into that sort of like bustier top. It doesn't matter. They take her flannel shirt and they turn it into that kind of bustier top for the, you know, puffy skirt.
Yeah, it's very vintagey.
Yeah. It's a very cool moment, and it's directly lifted from Pretty in Pink.
But
yeah. And that's not a problem.
Her friend did it for her, which is signifying
their connection. They've reconnected. Right. And I appreciate that. I appreciate that she reconnects with her friends at the end. Here are the moments where
I'm still reeling. How as a girl in the United States did you not watch Pretty in Pink as a kid?
Here's the thing. I am Asian.
Right.
And when I caught Pretty in Pink on cable on Bravo, when Bravo used to show movies, it was the long duck dong scene.
No, that's 16 Candles.
Oh, okay. I don't know the difference, obviously. But I saw that, and then I was like, oh, every time that like I see Molly Ringwald's face, I think of like one of the most like
horrifying Japanese stereotypes.
Yeah, and it was one of those things where...
Or Chinese.
It was really weird to me that...
Japanese actor, Chinese character.
Yes. It was really weird to me, like, that was, like, a real thing.
Oh, it was
because
a real
I thought it was
thing.
A
yeah.
joke, and so I kept waiting for, like, the punchline to come.
No.
And then that ended up being the whole joke, and it really put a bad taste in my mouth.
Long Duck Dong is to 16 Candles as Mickey Rooney is to Breakfast at Tiffany's. So it's an otherwise lovely movie.
Although you won't hear a word out of Getty Watanabe. He's like, look, I did that.
Yeah, no, he has a sense of humor about it, and yeah. Obviously was good for his career, so he's like, eh,
yeah. Yeah, I mean, like, I mean, what other roles were there for right. him? I don't blame him. Right. I blame John Hughes.
There's only so many productions of Pacific Overtures that were going on at that time. Yeah.
But anyway.
He was in the original
cast. So here's where I agree with you. That was the English sentence that I was trying to get out of my mouth when nothing but garble emerged. I like that they reconcile at the end of the film, she and her friends. I like that the romance, although entirely predictable, between her and the jock, I like how it's handled. Because she doesn't give him an inch.
No.
She sasses him back every single time. And I did appreciate that. And those lines were funny. Like, she's good with the one-liners. And Mae Whitman is, in fact, quite good in this film.
Yeah, there's one line I feel... Can I spoil it?
Do it.
So at this point, go for it.
She charges into the boys' locker room, and there's, like, one guy who's like, hey, what are you doing here? And he's like... And she just sort of was like, you know what? You know, that looks like a penis, but, like, smaller. Which, I mean, she sells that line way better than
I can. Oh, that's an old joke, too. Okay. But, right. But if she sells it, she sells it.
She sells it.
She does. She's very good. And then, like... funny. And then right when she goes up to him, there's, like, a... Another amazing scene where he, like, punctuates every one of his one-syllable answers to her questions with, like, a peck bounce. Yeah. Like, there's, like, lots of different kinds of humor in this. Okay. And also, and they just pull every single joke off to me. So I did not mind the formula at all. And I feel like a lot of the...
And she says even something even better after the penis thing. She's like, now you know how it feels for us.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I liked that. So there are elements of your endorsement of this film that I'm with. What I cannot get behind is the idea, and it seems like it's plastered all over the film, that girls, you're beautiful just as you are. But wouldn't you like it better if you had a boyfriend and you dressed better? Don't you need a better bra?
Here's the thing,
if a man tells you your boobs aren't good enough, you really ought to listen to him, because your boobs probably do need help. Like, that's what I'm hearing in this film. I'm seeing it on the screen, and I think I don't feel like the characters were as developed as I wanted them to be. I don't think I saw any characters that I'm going to remember forever. These are not the characters of Clueless or Pretty in Pink or Breakfast Club. And the movie, again... kind of slags, it doesn't slag off Breakfast Club, but it says, well, back in the 80s, you were the princess and the basket case and the jock and the geek and the blah, 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 which is obviously a reference, a direct reference to the Breakfast Club.
I thought it was interesting, though, that even though she would like to believe that there are no such things as labels anymore, there clearly are.
I think the film suggests that you old people don't know what it's like anymore. And I really think that's hilarious, because the truth, nothing ever actually changes. And it's the same. The words are different. The labels are different. But it's the same thing. And
did you learn nothing from 21 Jump Street, though? That movie makes it very clear. The nerds are in charge now. As long as they look like Dave Franco.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, okay, so here's the thing. I'm going to go see The Duff this week, yes. And then I will provide the actual true tiebreaker here and tell you who's right. And since we have Ingu here, this movie is still in theatrical release. It's also available.
Fighting Round 2 on demand. Begins
that's
now.
Right, yes. Now we're going to talk about the last 5 years again, because I rather liked this movie, and Ingu rather did not. This is, we talked about it on the show. It's the musical with... Anna Kendrick and Jeremy Jordan. It's about a couple over the entire arc of their relationship from first meeting to breaking up. And her story is told backwards and his story is told forwards. They sort of meet in the middle when they get engaged. And it's almost entirely sung based on an off-Broadway musical by...
Jason Robards Brown.
Jason Robert Brown.
Sure.
Yes, who did Parade and several other
Jason musicals. Robards?
Not
Jason Robards. Jason Warren Robert Bacall's Brown. and it's brought to the screen by Richard LeGravenez, who directed one of my kind of favorite movies. Well, he directed a YA franchise that I would have liked to have seen go somewhere, which was Beautiful Creatures. Because that movie was nutty. Oh, you're making a face. Okay, well, maybe not. I thought it was... Look, you give me Margot Martindale in an evening gown carrying a peacock, and I'm yours, you know. Okay, so last 5 years. Now, so why did you not respond to it?
It just felt so inauthentic to me. And I know that's a really stupid charge to launch at a movie that is sung all the way through. But I mean...
You, but character-wise, you mean dramatically.
I can't believe Dave is attacking the Duff for having no developed characters. The last 5 years has absolutely, completely implausible characters.
I haven't seen the last 5 years yet.
That's okay.
Implausible? Why? Because he's a successful author?
They're very flat, first of all, because she's just sort of like failed actress and then has like nothing more to her. And then he has a crazy, successful, amazingly successful... author, which doesn't make sense whatsoever.
Well, they exist. I mean, it's like winning the lottery, but they do exist out there. I didn't
believe him because he had like absolutely nothing interesting to him to suggest that he might have this great genius that would make him amazingly successful.
But do you think if you saw Jonathan Franzen on a day-to-day basis, he would be, you know, splitting the atom or something that would make him different from mere mortals? I don't know that writers always necessarily have lives that were so tumultuous forever that that's where it all comes from.
I feel like the way that you were just talking right now even suggests that you are a writer. No, I'm being completely serious. The way that you speak, I think, is writerly. Uh-huh. Whereas, like, with this guy, his dialogue did not seem writerly to me. And I also felt like they were basically, you know, poles instead of actual characters. And that's what I didn't like. And so... It like the music didn't work for me, and I think that's more like a personal thing where I don't like musical theater music, even though I thought I did, but whatever.
Do you like certain kinds, like Rodgers and Hammerstein or Sondheim or something specifically, but not all of it?
I like Les Mis. I don't know.
Okay. That's a thing.
They had sort of like enough chemistry, but not enough to actually... make me root for them in any way whatsoever.
Well, I don't know that you ever really have to, given that the movie begins with them having broken up. Like, it's sort of... I don't know that there's a... You necessarily have to get in a position where you're rooting for the relationship because you know it's doomed anyway.
Not,
you know,
like, in the sense of rooting for them to stay together, but in terms of actually feeling sad that it's over.
I see.
Like, I think the thing that I wrote in my review... is that for a romance to work for me, you don't necessarily have to like the characters, but you have to like what they like about each other, or you have to like the way that they love each other. And to me, there's sort of like one scene around Christmas time where he sort of like...
The Shmuel song, yeah.
Yeah. Where he's sort of like carrying her around the room and it's like kind of cute. But other than that, I have no idea what they like about each other.
I thought that was a really great number in terms of showing them when the relationship was at its best. I also like the I Can Do Better, or, you know, when they're in the convertible driving to New Jersey. That to me felt like they were really into each other, and there was a sort of a palpable sense of them being a couple. Because you're right, a lot of the movie is them either getting to know each other or, like, the relationship disintegrating. But I felt like there were a couple of moments here where you're like, okay, yes, there's a seed in here that could have grown into something, you know. I disagree about the idea that she's merely a failed actress because, you know, you're always seeing her doing other stuff, like she's making dresses, you know, she's taking pictures. Like, she seems to be one of those people who's creative in a million different directions, but never quite can nail one down. And he even says that in the Shmuel song about the 10,000 people you are, and how, you know, giving her this opportunity to, like, look, I'm gonna let you just pursue stuff. I'll, you know, I'm giving you the time, you know. I don't know. I really liked the music, which I'm sure helps a lot. But I really responded to the way they were together, and I don't think it's 100% successful. We were talking before about how it's easy to get lost in the chronology because ostensibly it's like on stage, it's the two of them are just sort of singing to the audience, and they're only interacting during the scene where they get engaged in the middle when they meet.
Right?
No, in the middle of the film. So the rest of it is So in this movie, they're in each other's scenes and sometimes even singing together. So you're not sure, wait, is this her moving backwards or is this him moving forwards? Like, when is this audition taking place? So that lost me a little.
And the thing is that, like, the chronology is everything for that movie. And I think that the other thing is that you got very little sense of why one scene follows another, especially because both of those characters were in every scene compared to just one of them at a time.
Yeah, because he is pretty much always successful, and she's, in certain varying degrees, always unsuccessful. And having those in a more clarified order, you're right. I think it would make more dramatic sense and give us more of an idea of he's on the rise and she's not quite making it, you know. And
then she's suddenly in Ohio, like by a lake, and you have no idea why, but she sure is angry at him.
Right. Well, but that gets explained later, and I could sort of go with it. You know, that didn't bug me so much. I knew you had an issue with her being blonde, which bugged me for about a scene, and then I got used to it. But I think the idea was that...
No, it's not that she was blonde. I'm okay with a blonde Anna Kendrick. It was that the dye job was so terrible.
They
gave her, like, a weird brassy
They could have done it better, yeah. I just figured that, you know, if he's going to sing about her as a shiksa goddess... She looks too not... Like, she could play Jewish without doing anything.
Can I just say I hated that song? Because really? The whole song takes place in, I think, her apartment while they're peeling each other's clothes off. Uh-huh. And he's singing about what his mom's going to think. And it's just like, wait, why are you thinking about your mom?
Well, because he's a Jewish guy who's about to have sex with a non-Jewish
woman.
What
is this, like the 60s? Like, Woody Allen? No, seriously.
I think that I could... That's still a thing where you're supposed to stay in the tribe. I don't know.
I'm sure it's still a thing, but as far as cultural representations go, I'm so eager to see something else. And also, saying one thing about Woody Allen, I cannot believe that man has been in an interracial relationship for over 20 years and yet is so cowardly to actually show one on screen. I have no idea what that's about. No, but come on.
It's true, yeah. We got Chiwetel Ejiofor in Melinda and Melinda, and that was sort of the last time we saw a person of color in one of his movies in a major romantic role. One thing that bugged me about your review was you called out the line where she says, I want to be your wife, I want to bear your child, which... out of context is a clunky bit of lyrics, I grant you. But if you include the stuff that comes before it and the stuff that comes after it, it's not that bad.
Did you want me to include, like, all of the song
lyrics? I've kind of felt like you were gunning for it in a way. That it didn't seem fair. Like,
I never go into a movie hoping I'll hate it along
there. No, I know. I mean, it just, like, you could take, like, a stray line out of, like, with something in West Side Story and make it sound, like, dopey. You know, like, something out of G. Officer Krupke or something. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. I just I get your point, and I'm not throwing myself on the sword of this movie because it has problems. Like I said, the chronology is handled much better in a movie like Two for the Road, which Dave and I did a commentary for, where you jump back and forth in time and you always know exactly when you are. And this movie doesn't do it as well. But I did buy the soundtrack. I've been listening to it. Those songs have kind of gotten in my head. So
are you listening to the original one or the movie one?
The movie one. Yeah,
did you like them as singers?
I did, yeah. I mean, Kendrick has an interesting quality. I remember thinking in Into the Woods, like when she's doing On the Steps of the Palace, I was like, okay, she's really good at this sort of, the kind of comical stuff. But then I wondered how she was going to be for the more serious stuff later on. But then they get to, you know, No One Is Alone, and I got a little weepy. And I was like, okay, so she can do this too. Okay, you're making a face.
That song was just execrable.
The way it was done in the movie, or the song itself?
No, just that song. I mean, it obviously in Into the Woods tried to bring the whole movie to some kind of thematic closure, and it just didn't work for me in the least.
Wow.
But I mean, that's like a completely different conversation. I will say that I enjoy, even though I really did not like the last 5 years, I do enjoy Anna Kendrick's whole, like, I'm a musical gal turn. I like Pitch Perfect because I'm a person.
Sure.
And I'm looking forward to the sequel.
Me too.
And she was not the best thing because that was Emily Blunt, but she was fine and Into the Woods.
Absolutely.
Emily and Blunt. I hope she keeps doing this stuff, actually.
Yeah. I mean, did you ever see Camp?
No.
Oh, man. You have to see Camp. 12-year-old Anna Kendrick busts out.
Is she 12 in the film? Was she 12 when she was in the film?
I think so, yeah. Because really? it's from the early 2000s.
Yeah.
Busts out this version of Ladies Who Lunch from Company after poisoning the person that she's understudying. From that moment, I was like, okay, this kid is going places. And she has indeed. And she's still doing, that was the whole thing with the 60s, where suddenly you had people like Richard Harris and Lee Marvin starring in musicals because the people who were big box office draws were not also the people who could sing and dance. But I like that there's always somebody in the mix who is a name and a draw and has appeal outside of musicals, but they can do musicals. And, you know, there's even a joke in the last 5 years when she's auditioning, like these are the people who put Russell Crowe in a musical. You know, so I'm glad that she gets to occupy that niche.
She was 16.
In Camp?
In Camp, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
God, she's so little.
Yeah, she's tiny. Well, she's tiny.
Well, she's a tiny, yeah. But in that movie, she seems like she's 11.
Right. The one part of that...
She's probably playing younger.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
The one part of her actress career that I did like is when she's sort of about to... She's thinking, you can tell for like the umpteenth time, of actually quitting acting. And she goes on this audition... And then she says, like, oh, there's, like, all of those guys, because they're always guys. And maybe, right. like, one of those guys is gay, but they're always guys. And then she feels extremely judged. And, you know, I grew up in L.A., so I don't naturally have, like, a high opinion of actors or acting. But I did appreciate that was sort of, like, a very human moment as far as what felt like it to me. And then... That moment was punctured for me when she starts singing, I suck, I suck, I suck, I suck, I suck.
Right, but that's a moment of doubt, though, which I think all performers have in an audition that's not going well. It's like in a chorus line where they're doing, you know, I think I got it, and then the next part is, God, I really blew it, you know. So I don't know that that's her saying, I'm terrible. I think it's her saying, oh, God, this isn't working, I'm the worst, you know. I think that's just a moment of doubt, which I think every actor has.
No, I'm saying I really hated listening to her singing I suck over and over again.
She says it like 4 times.
No.
It's on my phone. I'll play it.
We'll get back to this.
But no, that whole bit where that's actually one of my favorite moments, where, you know, you hear her audition song, which is this sort of straightforward kind of love song, and then she does it again, and all the lyrics are like, why is this pianist, you know, sabotaging me? I shouldn't have worn these shoes, you know, and you know, why is this guy looking at my crotch? Don't read my resume. I made up everything on my resume. You know, I don't know. But, okay, so I just wanted to have it out with you, but now we've covered that ground. So let's move on to the important film of the week, which is, of course, Hot Tub Time Machine 2.
Have we all seen it? Did you see it?
I have not seen
lucky
it.
Lucky you.
Lucky person. Can we get it done in 60 seconds?
I don't see why not.
Let's try.
This time, instead of going to the 80s, they go 10 years into the future. John Cusack is nowhere to be found, but they find Adam Scott, who is John Cusack's son.
Yes.
Nothing very interesting happens.
They kill Rob Corddry at the beginning of the movie. This is in the trailer, so that's not a spoiler.
So they go to figure out...
They shoot him in the junk.
Yeah.
And that's how he dies, because that is the most important part of his body. And he...
They go to the future to fix the past.
They gotta go to the future so they can find his killer and stop it. I think they were trying to go to the past to stop it.
But the tub takes him to the future.
They wind up in the future, but he's still alive, and nothing makes any sense, and it doesn't matter because this film doesn't care.
Right. It's allowed to not care about the time travel stuff, but it should care about being funny.
It does not care about the time travel stuff, so if you're looking for it to be like, you know... an ambitious sort of film like Looper.
They reference Looper.
It's not even as logical as something like Project Almanac, which...
It's not even as logical as Hot Tub Time Machine 1 was.
Which, you know, if you want a time travel movie, Project Almanac is not garbage. SpongeBob is better than all of them.
Yes.
And the problem here is that it's just not very funny. There are laughs... But they're the kind of laughs where you're sitting in the theater and you're doing this.
as Ben said, I was like, he goes, I wrote down a line that made me laugh, and I realized later, in another movie, I wouldn't have laughed, but in this one, I was so desperate to be amused by something.
You're like, and that happens about every 5 minutes. You go, that ain't enough.
No.
Not for, and I mean, the problem with this franchise is that it's such low stakes.
Yeah. They think that by announcing up front that it's ludicrous because it's a hot tub time machine, that that lets them off the hook from then being smarter than the concept.
Right.
You know, which
and
they, need
they
to
just
be.
Don't try.
Yeah.
My favorite part is when Craig Robinson records his version of Lisa Loeb's Stay.
Yes.
And he's filming the video, and you realize that every hit song he has that he has stolen from some other artist before they got a chance to do it,
right,
he's got the lyrics are half remembered.
Yes.
So he just sort of mumbles through the song.
It repeats things over and over
again. Repeats things over and over. And as they are shooting the film music video, Lisa Loeb shows up, and he goes, "Oh, look, it's Lisa Loeb." And she goes, "You know my name," because he's the famous one.
And she's the tea girl.
And she's the cat wrangler.
Oh, that's sort of the cat
in
wrangler.
In the video. And she's like, "I really love this song. It's very personal to me, and something makes me feel very sad." And I dig Lisa Loeb for that. And that was actually probably the one time I truly laughed.
Gillian Jacobs gets a whole lot of nothing at all to do.
The smart car bits are funny.
The smart car bits are kind of funny. But yeah, overall, this is... And then worst of all, I hate a movie that wants to be sort of R-rated and raucous and obscene and then tack on this moralizing at the end where suddenly everybody has to go to rehab.
Yeah.
I thought, what? It felt like one of the producers got stuck with community service during the shoot. And they had to just shoehorn that into the script somehow.
It's...
Do not bother.
It's a drag. It's just really...
Yeah. P.U. All right, moving on. You saw McFarland USA.
Yes, I did. And I was so not looking forward to seeing it because I had just recently seen Black and White.
Black or White.
Whatever.
You gotta pick one because one is better than the other. I don't need to tell you which one.
No, I know. I know.
He's on your page on that one.
I know. In case anyone has missed the episode where we discussed Black and White.
Black or White.
I don't care. I don't care.
No, Black and White is a whole other movie. It's a James Toback film.
It is also a great Michael Jackson song.
No, Black or White is a Michael Jackson song.
Okay.
Black and White is a great cookie.
Anyway, Black or White.
Thank you.
Is a garbage movie.
Yes.
About how white people are so great. And black people are the craziest, most irrational, non-ability to parent children people in the world. That's what Black or White is about. McFarland USA is this whole other thing. Kevin Costner, who is a veteran of the White Savior film, Dances with Wolves, Black or White. I'm sure there are others that I'm not thinking of. Comes along as what you would assume to be the white savior. And then the film sort of sidesteps all around that. It's a true story. It happened in 1987 in McFarland, California, which is in the Central Valley, and it's a town primarily populated by Mexican migrant workers and their kids. So he shows up, sort of his last chance as a high school teacher coach, because he's had trouble in every school he's been to. And he gets sort of dumped into this school. And they have a bad football team. And he realizes that the kids are not suited for football, that what they should in fact be doing is running cross country, because they are constantly running to and from all of their incredibly packed day obligations, which include getting up at 4:30 in the morning to go pick crops in the fields with their parents before school and then do it again after school. So he's like, what if we had a cross-country team? Let's get all these kids off football and put them in the cross-country team. He does that. And what happens in the next 14 years is that he leads them to like 10 state championships. This really happened. Mm-hmm. This is a real thing. And so... there is a problem, I concede, with that the idea that this is the story that gets told. The white teacher goes into the right. non-white environment and gives the kids this opportunity. There should be more films about teachers of color doing this very same
stand
thing.
Stand By Me.
That doesn't happen enough. Yeah, Stand By Me. I mean, Stand and Deliver.
Stand and Deliver.
Stand and Deliver, yeah. Having said that, in the teaching profession, there are just more white teachers. What was interesting to me is that as a former middle school teacher, who taught English as a second language in Texas. And so all of my kids were Mexican or Vietnamese, and we had a tiny little percentage of Bosnian kids and a smattering of kids from Africa and the Middle East. The similarities between the way my kids treated me and the way his students in his movie treated him.
Well, because his last name is
Jim White. And so he shows up, and they all immediately, they don't call him Mr., they don't call him Coach, they just call him White. Or they call him Blanco. And I sat through the whole film thinking, when are they going to start calling him Bolillo? Because that's what my kids called me. Now, Bolillo... Bolillo is a little sort of like a small loaf, a little bun. It's a small loaf of white bread. It is also a bit of a slur, but not really. It's kind of like if a Mexican person likes you and you're white, they might call you Bolillo because that's just a cute diminutive. Something somewhat derogatory but affectionate name.
Mm-hmm. A tiny ball.
A tiny ball of dough. That's what you are.
Meanwhile,
I was a giant ball of dough, and my kids were 3 feet tall because I was teaching sixth grade. But they called me Mr. Bolillo often. And so I found the relationship between him and his students in the film very real, because it's how it happened with me, too. The kids were combative, alternately respectful, questioning him. And here's what the movie really does well. It takes the white savior motif. It takes the white savior, storyline, and kind of kicks it in the face a lot by making it a story about how this white family is slowly and very patiently welcomed into the fold of this community of all Mexican people who are migrant workers. And they teach the white people pretty much more than the white people teach them. All the coach does is say, okay, now we're going to have this cross-country team. Go do it. And they do it. The sport aspect of it is kind of not even the most exciting thing in the film. Mm. It's sweet, it's gentle, it's kind-hearted, it's incredibly sincere. Mm. It's the best movie that's out this week. And I wish they could sell it in a way that emphasized what's really going on in the film rather than what you're ready to understand about a sports film or about a film where...
A sports movie with Kevin Costner specifically. White coach comes in. That's almost a genre unto itself.
Fixes, the Mexican kids.
Right.
It's much better than what you might think it is going to be.
So how many state championships did you take your children to?
I wasn't a coach.
Hey, neither was Edward James Olmos.
Yeah. We had no competitions. There were no linguistic competitions in Fort Worth, Texas for ESL students. I took my kids to the ballet. Yeah, I did that.
And they spoke a lot more English after your class than
before. They voluntarily went with me to the ballet, my kids. They were all like, it was time for Christmas vocabulary. The holidays, we were teaching the holidays, and it was time for that vocabulary. And so I showed them the Macaulay Culkin Nutcracker. And here's what's great about that. There's no dialogue other than Kevin Kline's narration. And so it's the perfect kind of visual thing to teach language with, because what you have then is a situation where the students have to describe it to you. You turn down the sound and they have to speak about it to you using the vocabulary of the holiday situation. It's a really a great teaching tool. Fort Worth Ballet, a really respected company in the southwestern United States that often feeds dancers into bigger, more prestigious companies. They were performing the Nutcracker. And I told my kids, who wants to go? You want to go? If you go, you want to go, I'm going to get a teacher in the school to pay for your ticket. The teachers did not know this at the time. I just said that I would do it. And then at lunch I said, oh, by the way, to all the teachers, I volunteered all of you to buy the kids tickets. Who's in? They all stepped up.
Nice.
They're like, they really want to go to the ballet. I was like, they said they did. They said, how many boys? I said, three. Three boys. Three middle school boys. They're like, yeah, I'll go to the ballet. They had no idea what they were getting themselves into. But it was great.
Nice.
So no, I didn't take them to any competitions. I took them to high culture.
I feel like a really good version if you were still a teacher but also couldn't wrangle up the ticket prices, is to show them a one of those like Nike videos for with Misty Copeland in them. That they write an essay describing Misty Copeland's legs.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
I would read all of those essays.
That's the kind of stuff. I mean, I really went out to try to make this.
The vocabulary list would have to have sinewy on them or something.
Right.
So, also opening this week about people of color without any white people of note is Drunktown's Finest, which is the directorial debut of Sydney Freeland. She won the Grand Jury Prize at Outfest last year. She also won the HBO Best First Screenplay, I believe it is, prize. It was like $5,000. And I'm about to show this to my class in about a month or so. So I'm very excited about this movie. And Ingu saw it as well. You want to sum up the plot real quick?
I don't know if I can do that. But so it's three interlocking stories, all taking place at or right outside of a Navajo reservation in New Mexico. And so you have one character who is this guy who is an expecting father. You know, his wife is probably like 8 months pregnant. And he just can't stop getting into trouble because he enlisted for the army, and he just has to wait out like 2 weeks or 2 months or whatever until he gets shipped off somewhere. And he thinks he's doing like the right, like manly, responsible thing of leaving his wife at home, taking care of his younger sister so that he can provide for the family. But the very first scene of the movie is him punching out a cop while he's drunk right outside of a convenience store. So, you know, that guy's not good at staying out of trouble. So that's one of the stories about how he's going to become a man. And then there's another story about a Christian Native... she is a Native American girl in high school. She's about to go to college, but she was adopted by a white family. And there is a little bit of weirdness about her adoption. And her white adoptive parents are extremely not into her search for her actual biological family because she's an orphan, but obviously her parents had relatives. And so she goes into the reservation very hesitantly to try to find them. And then there's a third story about a transgender sex worker. And she sort of has like the saddest story because she's trying to make it as a model. And so she enters this beauty pageant /
calendar shoot
thing. And she's almost immediately discovered by one of her former high school classmates who remembers her as Felix and not as Felicia. And so a lot of it is about this fractured community and these fractured families and how they're going to try to have a better life for themselves and if they can. And the title of the movie comes from a old 2020 segment that the writer-director watched when she was a kid. And basically the 2020 segment was about how her hometown was called like Drunk Town USA,
right?
Which not so flattering. And I guess what's sort of interesting maybe is that instead of dispelling all of these stereotypes about Native American communities, she just sort of gives you what it's actually like to live with all of those stereotypes of alcoholism, of broken families, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't think she's going, I don't know how many like Native American pride badges she's going to get from the community.
Well, but I don't think she's making it from a point of view of like, oh, look how terrible this is. I think it's sort of like, well, yeah, these are the circumstances, but here are some characters who are trying in different ways to move past this or to, you know, I think the characters who really kind of are holding all this together, both in terms of their connection to all of these disparate people, are the older couple, where like the grandfather had been like a medicine man or something like that, and the movie is sort of subtly implying that the tools for fixing this community are within the community's own history, and maybe I think she's suggesting that there's a certain embracing of tradition and of the past that could help the modern community. That was my takeaway. I don't know if you might disagree, but
I mean,
that's a fix it for everything, but that at least if they can at least kind of get in touch with their roots and where they came from, that's a start in sort of fixing themselves and finding their own identities.
The movie doesn't end sadly at all, but I don't think I mean my reading of the movie was not as optimistic as yours because while there's a big focus on how each of these characters sort of try to make sense of their native American identity, I mean it's not like that particularly is going to help the guy character like find a job so he can support his family.
Well, sure, yeah. Like I said, it's not necessarily meant to be a fix. I think it's just in terms of these people are all sort of broken in different ways, and it's sort of, I think the idea being that if they can heal themselves, that then they can, that will allow them to sort of deal with the world as it exists, and whether it's the reservation or off the reservation. What I like about the movie, and kind of the reason that I'm showing to my class, is the idea of, I like how she brings us into this world and doesn't give us a Kevin Costner to sort of be our guide. Like, she just kind of plunges us right into it, and we're meant to use our eyes and ears and follow what's going on and not have to be sort of handheld through the whole thing. So I like that about it. I think she's a really strong storyteller, and those characters just immediately pop and you know who they are and you really get a sense of what they're doing and what they want, you know?
And I think, I don't know if we know that this already, but the writer-director herself is
trans.
At least, oh.
Oh,
yeah. I was going to say part Native American.
Oh, that too.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
She's Navajo. She's also trans.
Okay. And I like that it doesn't make like a big deal out of the trans thing either. You're just sort of like, hey, deal with it.
Right. Well, and which is great because I think also if there's ever been a culture historically that was accepting about that kind of thing, it's the Native Americans. You know, you have the whole third sex, Berdash, you know, however you pronounce that word, tradition, where there were... In a lot, you know, you read about historically that there were people in the tribe who sort of occupied a middle space, and so they might be genetically male, but they tended to the children and they did sort of women's tasks, and oftentimes even
was it gay or trans though?
Well, it's both because
it's both.
Because sometimes like those people would the Berdash would be coupled with a male member of the tribe.
Got it.
So it's, you know, they were...
I don't know enough about this.
Yeah, I don't know a ton either. I have a smattering of understanding of it. But I just know that historically speaking, like, that's a culture that's always been very sort of understanding about the fluidity of both gender and sexual orientation.
Even now?
Not so much now. Like, I've seen documentaries about, you know, gay kids on reses who committed suicide because...
Gay kids or trans kids?
Both.
Okay.
But, you know, I think that's where, thank you, Christian missionaries, that's right. Where, you know, that sort of thing comes in. I think Drunk Town's Finest is really beautifully done and a really strong first film. And it's opening, it's in limited release, you know, if it comes near you or if it, you know, once it's available on demand, if it's not already showing where you live, by all means, seek it out. I think it's a really powerful film. And then the last thing is the movie that I saw this week, Wild Tales, which is opening, I think, New York and L.A., and I'm not sure where else, but it'll be making its way around. It is nominated for Best Foreign Film this weekend at the Academy Awards. It's from an Argentine filmmaker named Damian Cifrone, who's done a couple of features and a lot of TV in Argentina. I've never heard of him before. I don't think his stuff has really made it to the States. But this movie premiered at Cannes last year. Pedro Almodovar is a producer of it and gets a presents credit on the American release. It's an anthology film. It's sort of six different stories. They don't interlock in any way. But thematically, they kind of work together. They're sort of about... there's a theme of revenge, there's a theme of sort of, you know, rage. A lot of them are kind of very underdog against the oppressor, but not all of them. And it's really funny, but funny in that sort of, you know, I remember my sister Cheeky always tells the story about, you know, there was something they were reading in class, and this character talks about this awful thing that happened, and she started laughing, and no one else did. And the teacher's something like, oh, that dark Spanish humor, you know. There's a lot of dark Spanish humor in this movie. But if you like Almodovar, and you like his brand of the sort of, you know, twisted comedy, I think you would respond to this. I mean, it's just all the, and what Cifrone does really well is, you know, when you read a novella that's like six pages, by the end of the second paragraph, you are in the world. You know the context, you know what's going on, who the characters are, or at least who the main character is and what the stakes are. Each one of these things, he so immediately just sort of envelops you into everything you need to know. And, you know, it's like six really great short films put together, but they're thematically linked. There's not a lame-o, you know, usually with an anthology film, there's always the worry of that one that doesn't work. But this one, they're all really solid. I don't want to talk about it too much because it's the surprises are worth, you know, discovering. So I'm not going to spoil anything, but this probably would have made my top 10 list had I seen it last year during its awards run. It's certainly, I think, going to be on my, it's one I'm going to be thinking about for this year because it's just so sharp and funny. It's kind of like Force Majeure in terms of just that sort of, it's funny in that awkward way of like just people doing and saying terrible things or being caught in a really awkward situation, and it just becomes really funny. I definitely recommend it. You should totally watch it, David. Right. I think you'll love it.
Yeah, that plane crash at the beginning is going to be wonderful.
Well, okay, once you get past that part, and that's in the trailer.
Can't wait for that.
Maybe we'll just skip to the credits and maybe watch the rest of it.
That's what we might do.
But I would watch it again with you. I like it a lot.
Do we have any ad copy from Mr. Martin?
Not this week.
Not this week?
Not this week.
Okay. Well, let's do one for ourselves.
Yes.
Hey, you, listener. You want to listen to us talk about the Poseidon Adventure.
Sure you do.
For 2 full hours.
For the entire length of the film and a little bit more.
That's why we have created yet another episode of Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife.
With our friend Brian Boskin.
With our friend Brian Boskin.
Who knows a whole ton about the Poseidon Adventure and the behind-the-scenes stuff and insider information. It's a really, I think, one of our best ones. And he brought a lot
to it. They're all one of our best ones, the ones that are out there.
I'm proud of all of them. But Brian really brought a lot to this one as our special guest. And yeah, if you're a Poseidon fan, I think you'll have fun with it. You might learn a few things. And it's not just trivia. We talk about sort of the larger context of when these movies came out and where they fit in the careers of the various people involved. And, it's good stuff.
We are, frankly, amazing.
We're fascinating.
Yes. It costs $1.99.
Yes, what a bargain.
You're going to pay. You're going to pay us. To linoleum...
linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. You can PayPal us there.
linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. It's $1.99, and then we send you the link.
Yes.
And you are happy after that.
And in addition to the Poseidon Adventure, you can also get our commentary tracks for Clue, for Josie and the Pussycats,
Two for the Road,
The Apple,
yep,
and for the holiday favorites, White Christmas and Santa Claus.
Which you probably don't want now because it is February.
Somebody just bought White Christmas off of me, so you never know.
To the person who just bought White Christmas, you need to make sure that you do not sit on that link or it will expire.
Yes.
So you need to put it wherever you're going to put it.
Well, all the links. Once you buy it, download it once I've sent it to you.
We've had people be like, oh, I bought it and then I sat on it for a while and then I tried to use it and it doesn't work. And so
I think this person is in New York that is currently blanketed in snow, so he was still in the mood for White Christmas. So maybe. Why not?
All right, so I got some letters.
Should we do DVD picks first?
Oh, yeah, DVD picks. Watership Down.
Yes, Criterion.
Criterion Watership Down. Do you like animated features, even though you are an adult? Good. This is Watership Down's... You're the audience. It's not for children.
Even though it's about bunnies.
It's a highly symbolic sort of story about life and violence and tyranny and escape and... rabbit against rabbit, and it is realistic and brutal and unhappy, so that's great. I love this film. I read the book when I was 12, barely understood it. I read it in middle school. The movie came out in 78. I was like 14. I went right out to see it. I was like, wow, this movie is much less complicated than the book. But it's still a very complex film. Hence Criterion putting out an edition of it right now. If you've never seen this movie, like I said, don't show your children, but you will like it. It has much more in common with a Miyazaki sort of approach and style than it does
Disney.
To the, you know, the Disney world.
I have never seen this film. I need to see it. I'm excited about it. And I tried reading the book when the movie came out and it, in junior high, and I never got through
it. The book is a little too much for kids to read.
Gotcha.
Not because it's too, you know, unpleasant. It's just dense. It's dense. Yeah.
Gotcha. My DVD pick this week is Dangerously Close, which is a canon release from 1986. A movie I have a lot of fondness for just because I saw it under sort of odd circumstances. In the summer of 1986, I was going to do that thing that so many college students do, where you get your Eurail pass and you trot around the continent and you stay in cruddy hostels and you see the great nations of Europe. And then we bombed Libya, and my best friend Clark Parsons, who is from Mobile, Alabama, his parents were like, "You're not going to Europe because they're going to be," I don't know what they thought. They thought they'd be shooting Americans in front of the Eiffel Tower. I don't know what they thought, but he didn't go. And I did not want to go by myself. I'm not one of those people that could just go to Europe by myself. I think to this day I could go to Europe by myself, but certainly not then. So instead, we spent a glamorous week in Daytona Beach, Florida, where it rained constantly. And so we went to a lot of movies, and it was mid-May, which back in the day, you know, now the summer movie season starts like the first weekend in May. But this was back when, you know, before Memorial Day, it was really kind of sketchy. Like, I remember that week seeing, like, Blue City with, you know, Judd Nelson and Ally Sheedy. Yeah. And one of the movies we saw was Dangerously Close.
Yep.
Which is, I had actually read this, the Rolling Stone article that I think it totally rips off, which was about this high school where these rich kids all sort of became student vigilantes and started, like, attacking, you know, the poors.
Yeah.
And so the movie is a very, very slick version of that, cast with a lot of sort of, you know, like, male model, international male types, all of whom look way too old to be in high school.
Yes.
But it has a really cool soundtrack from Enigma Records. That's where I first heard the Smithereens Blood and Roses.
It was the song that they played over the closing credits.
Right.
In fact, yeah.
And so, I don't know. I have a soft spot for that film. It stars John Stockwell, who wrote it and who went on to become kind of a fun B-movie director himself. He did Turistas and I forget what else.
I have a soft spot ish for that movie because it came out in the summer,
mm-hmm.
and I had come home for a bit to work at the movie theater where I was, you know, working
right
on school breaks. And on my day off, of course, I went to movies. I'm such a pathetic person. At the United Artists North Star 8 mm-hmm. in Garland, Texas. Right. I saw Dangerously Close. I was alone in the theater.
I think, yeah, Clark and I were too.
I went because it had a vague punk rock feel to it, and I was seeing as many of the punk rock movies at that time as I could get my eyes onto.
Did you ever put, like, raw egg in your hair?
Oh, Dave had a mohawk.
I had a mohawk.
No
I
photos was, exist. I was, I've never seen it.
Yeah,
but I've been told.
I was actual punk rock in the 80s. I'm old, as we've discussed. So I was young then, and I saw all those bands. I was there for Black Flag and Husker Du and Dead Kennedys and the Minutemen and the Circle Jerks and all the Butthole Surfers and Sonic Youth.
I was there for
those bands.
There is a punk character in Dangerously Close.
There is a punk character in Dangerously Close.
Who's the guy who's like the super drug head from Bachelor Party.
Yes, he is on the poster. And I saw this trailer, and he was in the trailer. And then I saw the soundtrack was, mm-hmm. as you said, it was from Enigma, which had a lot of like L.A. punk.
Yeah, Agent Orange was on their label.
Yeah, and
T.S.O.L.
And so I thought, well, this must be sort of a punk rock film, so I guess I'm going to go. It turned out very much not to be very punk rock at all. But I was there, and I, too, heard the Smithereens' song Blood and Roses in the trailer and in the over the closing credits, and I thought, I like that song, so I guess it's not a complete wash that I saw this film. The end.
Ingu?
Well, I'm recommending for this week one of my best of 2014 picks, which is Gina Prince-Bythewood's Beyond the Lights.
Nice.
And such a good movie.
It mm-hmm. is such a good movie, yeah. and no one saw it.
Nobody saw it.
And I don't understand it, because it's fantastic. It's just, not only is it fantastic, but it's just like a really good crowd pleaser of a romance where you have two very beautiful people in Gugu Mbatha-Raw, yeah, who right. is in Belle, and also Nate Parker. I guess was in other stuff. But
hey, Gugu Mbatha-Raw is also in Jupiter's Ending.
Oh, okay. I'm glad she's getting work. Yeah. With that face.
When I forget Nate Parker's name, I just think of him as future Denzel. Because that's kind of where he's going. Like, he's going to be a big movie star.
Okay.
There is no doubt in my mind.
I was more for her becoming a movie star. I mean, the movie's about her.
And she will, too. But I have a feeling she'll probably be more serious in her career than he will be.
Okay.
That's just my guess.
Or so, she'll do a Shonda Rhimes show.
I'm doing predicting in the way that I predict where I'm always wrong.
Yeah. Well, it's a very old-fashioned romance in a lot of ways, but in the way that's just like the most satisfying, where she plays a biracial pop star who's sort of supposed to be like Rihanna or someone who's very the whole
more like Ciara.
That's what I've heard, yeah, but I don't like, know who or
like
what.
Like Ciara's career is not as classy as Rihanna's.
She's a little dirty.
When I see this character, I'm like, okay, you are like Rihanna, and that's what we're gonna go with here, but you're kind of more like Ciara.
Yeah. I mean, she's sort of one of those pop stars that you know are going to disappear in a year because their whole appeal is based on sex appeal.
Yes. Right.
And she has a momager in Minnie Driver. Mm-hmm. I almost said Minnie White because she's white. Sorry.
She's white.
Yeah. Sorry, white people. And so
that's the sequel to Dear White People. Sorry, white people.
Not a phrase, by the way, that I ever thought I would say, but... So she has this mom.
Can we, when we promote the podcast,
yes,
can we call you Ingu Sorry White People Kang?
Where does the comma go there?
No, it'd be between quotation marks.
Sorry.
Oh, okay.
In between sorry.
Yeah,
and
sure.
Oh, I see. As opposed to no comma, which is even
weird. Right, right.
Okay.
And so basically, because she's put into this like very hypersexualized role that she's actually quite uncomfortable with,
yep,
she contemplates suicide in her hotel balcony after she wins some kind of MTV award.
BET. Like a Vibe award or something like that. Yeah.
And the cop who comes to save her, who's like assigned to be her bodyguard, this is very similar to the bodyguard, is the one who ends up falling in love, but his father, played by Danny Glover, is like, no, you should not hang out with this pop star because... you want to be a politician,
right?
And you don't want to waste your like respectable black man credibility on hanging out with a pop star,
right? Because there's a big thing about getting like the church endorsement or something,
yeah.
The neighborhood that they live in,
and that she's not sort of like read as respectable,
right?
And then at the same time, she has this sort of kind of real, kind of fake romance with one of her musical collaborators who is a white rapper. And he's apparently like a real white rapper, but
yes.
I don't know his name. I guess you do.
I don't know his name, but I know that he is a musician outside of the film.
Machine yes. Gun Kelly.
Yes.
And so anyway, the point is neither sides of their families want them to get together. And they decide, hey, parents, you just don't understand. And the way that they get together is just beautiful in the movie is... It just hits every mark that you would want a romance to, in that it is, you're looking at two very gorgeous people who are into each other, which is, of course, very important. But it's really smart. It has a lot of interesting things to say about two women who are sexualized as performers.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the relationship between the main character and her mother is actually quite interesting. And you never see Minnie Driver's character really as demonized as the movie could make her, that like a Lifetime movie would make her
sure,
into.
Sure, yeah.
And so it's a movie that's quite fair, I think, to everyone, and that's part of what makes it so good.
Yeah, no, I agree.
And it's just this really effective romantic drama, which just there aren't very many of those.
True.
That work.
It's old-fashioned in the good way, in the sort of this kind of, you know, it's the sort of thing that years ago might have been you know, written off as a woman's picture that we now look at like something that, say, Douglas Sirk would have made, where that's actually, there's a lot to take seriously, and that even stealthily, when women's pictures, when people weren't paying attention to them, it could actually say things about the plight of women in contemporary society. You know, and I think this movie is really smart about what it says about, you're right, about sexualizing female artists, about gender roles in general, about race, about, you know, sort of racial ambitions in a way. You know, there's a lot going on in this movie. It's really interesting. And yeah, those two lead performances are, in addition to them being gorgeous, they're really magnetic and they've got a ton of charisma.
This letter.
Yes.
Is from a person whose name I cannot pronounce.
Spell.
R-H-E-A-L.
Rail?
Real? Real? Rail?
I'm real!
Arheel.
Hi, guys. I really enjoy the show. I just saw Kingsman, so I was excited to hear your review about it. I can see where Alonso had his problem with the church scene. I guess I didn't really think about it, but at the time I thought it was more him versus them as opposed to him joining them in killing each other. He was just better at it. I, all caps, completely agreed with Dave about the last scene with the princess, the kidnapped princess. Mm-hmm. I don't know when you're going to read this, so if you want to spoil it, go ahead. I'm not going to. When she said the line, you know which one I'm talking about, the entire theater started whooping and laughing. And I just thought, really? And during the end, no pun intended, again, everyone started whooping, and not to spoil anything, but I thought it was, as Alonso put it, reprehensible. Thought the movie was good, other than those parts. It wasn't as good as Kick-Ass, but it was fun nonetheless. Again, I love the show. Real.
Why is Bibbs standing outside of our apartment?
It's our friend Bibbs and his lady friend, Michelle.
Who he's currently making out with, just FYI.
So they are. Okay.
Are they making out?
Did you know he was coming out?
I totally see them making out in the
reflection.
The reflection
of
the window.
Yeah, you're not fooling anyone.
They were led by the nose by the aroma of the muffins all the way from the west side over here.
I see. Okay.
Yeah, and they're here to consume them.
All right.
I'm going to... Why don't we pause this for a second?
So they can have muffins, and then we'll finish with letters. Okay, hang on. Okay, while Bibbs and his girlfriend are coming in, Ingo has to go. So thank you for being here. It was a blast always to have you on the show. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you know, and you can read Ingo at The Wrap. You can follow her at Village Voice. And you can follow her on Twitter at Thinkovision.
Yes.
Thinkovision. Ingo Kang, you're always welcome on this program. Thanks for coming.
I'm going to applaud for myself.
Yay! Bye. Okay, so Ingo is gone. Bibbs and his lady friend are enjoying muffins. Mm. Finish this letter.
That letter's over.
Oh, that is? Okay. Well, thank you, Rael. Or however, for getting your name wrong. Apologies. Yeah, we got some mixed response about our Kingsman review, but we're glad you saw where we were coming from.
Okay. So this is from Blake, and you had a back and forth with Blake.
I did. Because I posted the link to the show usually on Rotten Tomatoes.
Are we supposed to be reading this?
You can do whatever you want.
Okay. I'm just going to read it.
On Rotten Tomatoes, I usually just link my Wrap reviews, but if I review something here that I didn't review at The Wrap, I link it to us. And so that's the background for this letter.
Using the word reprehensible to describe a tongue-in-cheek spy movie is hilarious. The movie wasn't positioned as a Bond-like spy movie, nor did it promise less violence. If you can't have fun in this movie, readjust expectations. Okay, so here's your response.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, Blake. Have you seen the movie? We don't know. I don't know if you've seen the movie or not.
Solid question.
There's a scene of a brutal massacre that's played for laughs, complete with Free Bird on the soundtrack. Everyone will have their own take and opinion on it, as with anything else in art. But for me, that moment was reprehensible. Hope you listened to the episode and aren't just responding to my Rotten Tomatoes quote, since we discussed this in detail on the podcast. Thank you for your interest in Linoleum Knife. Blake's response to you.
Yes.
Yes, I saw the movie last night. Regarding the scene, it was a page out of Tarantino, so if anything, it could be called trite. I'm agreeing,
sure, yeah.
Using emotions that are nonlinear, humor, violence to stage a scene, has long been applauded. At no point did Kingsman take itself seriously, which made it a lot of fun to watch. For me, that's all I'm looking for most of the time. And you say we will have to disagree on our respective readings of that scene and its tone and intent. Okay, so that was just this little back and forth with you and him. I don't have the same problem with you.
No, we have the same problem. We have different issues with that movie.
You and I have different issues about that film.
Yeah. I'm right.
This is from Charlotte regarding The Kingsman. Mm-hmm. Regarding Kingsman. I saw it with my kid and I am horrified by the church shooting scene. I was so enraptured by the whole idea of the lower class beating out the upper class and the James Bond type gadgets. I took my 14-year-old kid, and I'm not sure that mothers have been warned about this. This is the most violent movie my kid has ever watched. I wonder if anyone counted the number of brutal murders in a small amount of time. Was there a Guinness Book of World Records for most murders per second in a film? Was it achieved? I can't understand how this gets past the ratings people. Well, I can explain that.
Oh, well, yeah. Cause...
Anyway, I wish I could have heard your review before this fiasco. You were quite right. I got away with it because...
It's a major studio, and it's not sex.
Incredibly stylized, cartoony violence. It's not, the violence is, again, my problem.
It's a major studio, and it's not sex. That's how you get an R rating.
On a previous week's episode, a listener suggested, this is from Renee, who has written
yes,
a number of times. On a previous week's episode, a listener suggested that Alonzo appeared to be giving Ben some dirty looks on What the Flick.
Not true.
I still love that. This reminded me of a What the Flick review from a few years ago where Ben made some joke about Matt, to which Matt replied with what you might call a nonverbal. A lot of the commenters speculated that Matt and Ben hate each other.
Oh, right. I think Ben made some joke about Matt's wife or something.
That was, really?
But not in a bad way. Like,
what?
It was something about liking something or not liking. It was all very harmless. And yeah, Matt shot him a look. And that became fodder for, like...
Here's the rest of the letter.
Anti-shippers.
I think it all boils down to people not liking Ben, which I understand.
Oh! Ben is lovely.
We've now had to defend Ben Mankiewicz twice.
He's a sweetheart. He needs to come on the show.
We need to have him on. Yeah. How is it we've been doing this for 4 years and we haven't had him on?
I know. I know
he's always out of town.
I mention it to him periodically. We'll make it happen. We'll get him on.
I like Ben. This continues. I like Ben. His tastes and political views are fairly similar to my own, but he has a habit of monopolizing the camera. Anyway, it's good to know that the What the Flick reviewers are all on good terms, although it is more fun to believe that you secretly resent each other.
We all got together for my birthday last year. We had a lovely time.
This is from Daniel regarding Pour That Tea.
Oh, yeah, Pour the Tea.
Pour the Tea.
Pour the Tea, which you gave me a hard time about. And several people on Twitter either agreed with you or agreed with me that it was an expression they'd heard.
And now all the homosexual grandpas are coming out of the woodwork to tell me I'm wrong.
Even young gays.
I know, I'm kidding. Sorry, homosexual grandpas.
Wait, Bib is making a face.
I reiterate.
I love all of you.
I'm still watching looking. Okay. I don't know yet.
All right, yes, I have to footnote looking for Bibs every week. Last week I made a comment about, I said that on your podcast that Richard Gravenet's poured the tea about Unbroken, and Dave didn't know what that meant. And to pour the tea is like to share the gossip.
Yes, that's true.
This is gay slang.
He also sewed a complete circle.
I don't know that one.
I don't know, I'm just making it up.
Oh, stop it.
I'm trying to start things. I don't follow trends, I create them.
There you go.
Regarding pouring tea, it is definitely still used, but it's more like, spill that tea, girl.
That works too.
Then he writes out the word sigh. That sigh was for me. One more.
Did you say who wrote that letter?
Daniel. I think we said it was Daniel. One time, this is from... hello, Dynamoxy.
Hey.
One time you guys were talking about the movie Grace of My Heart. I think I was listening to the episode for the second time, at least, and was thinking, that sounds like that weird movie that kind of collapsed all of the musical history of the 60s and 70s in one person's story. That was on TV that one time. Then I realized that there are not two movies that fit that description. I wanted to bring this up because seeing all of the posts about Leslie Gore passing away, I was similarly reminded of Grace of My Heart while having a sudden aha moment as to who the lesbian pop star in said movie was based on.
Right.
Bridget Fonda plays a Leslie Gore type.
Miss Lily Banquette.
Yeah. Unfortunately, that scene is a little too specific for anyone to have put a clip of it on YouTube, but it exists.
Well, but then read my response.
When are we going to have your pal Allison Anders on this podcast?
We shall see if I can make that happen. She's going to talk to my class this semester.
Yeah, so. You have her on sometime. That would be really
That
cool.
would be great. Yeah.
You said, oh, hey, well, aren't I glad I mentioned it? Ha ha!
Because, yeah, I sent her, there is, in fact, a YouTube clip of Bridget Fonda in Grace of My Heart doing her thing.
The end, we're done. That's what's happening. Goodbye.
Okay, you just stop doing that. People turn it off, and I have there's things to say.
As I run this.
I gotta. How can I not enterprise. Promote the B-Movies podcast with Bibbs and Whitney?
You can do it.
Bibbs
fine.
Is sitting at our
promote.
Table.
You can totally not promote
no,
it.
Anyway, well, I just did, so
oh,
there we go.
Right.
Also, check out ChristyLemire.com, the Rotten Tomatoes podcast, Malton on Movies, Dennis Anyone with Dennis Hensley, the Brett Easton Ellis podcast. I'm trying to do this without the paper in front of me. Fat Guys, the Movies, the Criterion cast. Secretly Timid, The Game Night Guys, Film Spotting SVU, and of course thanks to Blue for our lovely theme music. You can visit him at bluetopia.com, BLEUTOPIA. You can subscribe to this show for free at iTunes. Please leave us a review. It does help people find the show. You can stream us for free at Stitcher Radio or thelounge.com and leave us a little thumbs up there. There's also an app that allows you to stream the program at our Facebook page, Linoleum Knife Podcast. If you haven't liked us already, go please do. You can also join our Linoleum Knife group page where our audience members talk to each other about movies. And join our YouTube channel where I have been posting some of our vintage programs as YouTube files. That makes it any easier to get through them. You can follow us on Twitter at LinoleumCast and drop us a line at LinoleumPodcast@gmail.com with questions, comments, top 10 lists. And of course, that's also where you can PayPal us for our Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife episodes, including our most recent for the Poseidon Adventure. Do we know what we're doing next? Have we talked about that yet? We don't know yet. We'll figure it out. And we'll tell you when we know.
I don't know anything.
Anyway, as always, thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.
Yay. Okay, now for real. Goodbye.